KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Fratelli e sorelle, buonasera.
Probably just because I'm an advocate for everybody to tap dance, because I just think it's such a great joy. And it brings so much to my life that, you know, I can't imagine somebody not wanting to.
As far as I'm concerned, this is fantastic. All the rest is gravy in terms of how the rover is going to go about looking around this area, because it definitely was all the indications of being a habitable environment at one point in time.
It was pretty cool. It was very much like a dormitory, you know, with a lot of small units built around a common kitchen.
I have sort of gravitated towards issues that I don't know the answers to, because that's what's more interesting for me to write. The act of writing it is the act of trying to understand why my opinion is what it is.
Good evening, slugger. You see, I'm prompt. Slugger.
Boy, if we played all those back-to-back by the end of the week, we'd have like an hour's worth of programming there. That, you heard just then a little clip from an old radio show. We're going to talk about sound effects and directors today on the show. You also heard from Jodi Picoult, who's an amazingly best-selling author. She's got books in the millions around the world. We're going to talk to her what she likes to write and about her latest book, The Storyteller. And you heard from City Councilmember Tom Rasmussen talking about a small apartment he went to. Because we're talking about the rise of microhousing right now. On Weekday, I'm Steve Scher. The first micro-apartment complexes popped up in Seattle 6 years ago. Though the notion of small apartments were part of the fabric of the city for years, decades, century. Single-room occupancy hotels, boarding house, quads. This later iteration, one developer uses the term apodments, are small. With median rents at about $1,500 in Seattle for a month, people are looking for affordable options. Often these studio apartments are under 500 square feet. They range between $350 to $900 a month, with private bathroom and kitchenette. If you want an oven, a stove, larger cooking space, residents have access to shared kitchens. The micro apartments provide affordable living in high-demand neighborhoods such as Capitol Hill and the University District. Some developers say they're offering young people, cash-poor people, as well as empty nesters looking for affordable urban living, places to settle in the city. However, residents in some neighborhoods say the developments skirt zoning laws, allow developers to build without providing enough parking, create too much density too fast. Some critics are afraid that the buildings would be like dorms full of loud and transient populations. Tom Rasmussen of the Seattle City Council has discussed proposing a moratorium on microhousing or bringing the developments under the city's design review requirements. According to Rasmussen, there have been about 40 permits issued that will allow about 2,000 dwelling units to be built. They would be built in neighborhoods where there is generally a design review opportunity, but in this case, Rasmussen says, they don't meet the design review threshold.
That is, there has to be a certain number of units in a building before it comes up for design review. And the way these have been organized or planned, they don't meet that threshold.
So you'd like to change the rules so they would?
Yeah, that's one of the things that the community is asking for, is that the opportunity for a design review to ensure that there's an opportunity for public and community comment, and then to get a good design out of the project.
You visited some, I noticed. You went to look at some of this micro housing. What did you see?
I did. Well, it was brand new. No one had lived in there. I thought it was pretty cool. It was very much like a dormitory, you know, with a lot of small units built around a common kitchen. And so I could see that it would be a good place for, or an attractive place for people to live who don't want a large place or who want to keep the cost of housing low. And that's one of the things that we all support here at the council, of course, is having a range of affordable housing options. And I wouldn't want to discourage this. We just want to make sure that they do work for the community as well as the residents and the developers.
there are some people who look at this micro housing and say this is a sort of a reinvention of an older wheel. We are bringing back, in a different form, single-room occupancy hotels.
It's very similar to that, although they wouldn't be rented on a day-by-day basis. They are leasing these out. But I think that that is one of the concerns that's been raised by some of the neighborhoods is frequent turnover of the units. And, you know, what is to prevent someone who lives on Bainbridge or Vashon from renting one of those and using it for a weekend place? I guess that's okay, but one of the that question that came up is, what if you rented it and then you went online and rented it out to tourists?
Well, what if you did? Does that necessarily make the neighborhood less safe, less desirable?
I think those are the things we want to talk about. I think that what we should have is a conversation about this to determine if this is the kind of housing option that we want to encourage in the neighborhoods, or whether there need to be some limitations or restrictions on how it can be used. But there definitely are very attractive aspects of this, particularly affordable housing, housing that's close to transit, housing that's close to jobs. But we have to keep in mind, you know, some of the downside and some of the risks of this as well.
Tom Rasmussen is a member of Seattle's City Council looking into microhousing. The idea here is sufficient affordable housing. We're not building that at this point in the city, are we?
It's very challenging, that's for sure. And this is one of the affordable housing options that's been created by the developers. That's very true. We are trying to encourage more affordable housing by giving incentives. That is, you will get a larger building, a taller building, a bulkier building if you include our affordable housing in it.
Well, your colleague Mike O'Brien thinks we're not asking enough of developers who do enjoy those incentives. While at the same time, this is my interpretation now, you're looking at possibly restricting a private developer's incentive to move forward with what is affordable housing.
Oh, actually, I would say that while a moratorium is a possibility, the other thing that we have a number of options. We could do nothing and allow them to continue as they are. We could address the whole issue of design right away and adopt an ordinance that would be an interim control legislation that instead of being a moratorium that simply amends the design review thresholds for certain multifamily zones until the legislation that we think may be necessary with regard to parking, where these can go, and all of that is developed. So there's a whole range of options from doing nothing to a moratorium to design review thresholds being adopted fairly quickly.
Do those design review thresholds, if they were adopted or changed, why wouldn't they slow the development of these sorts of programs?
I do know that sometimes developers get very frustrated by the design review process, but in the end, I would say that most communities feel that design review has been very successful, and they're very happy to be able to participate in the development or the design of projects that are going into their neighborhoods. It is sometimes frustratingly slow, but it generally results in a better product that fits in quite well into the community.
Tom Rasmussen of Seattle City Council. You know, New York City has taken some steps for these micro apartments, mm-hmm. Seattle as well. Mm-hmm. You went to them. Some are awfully small, 90 square feet in a shared kitchen space. Some are a little larger, rents from $440 to $950. Can some be too small?
I think that 90 or 95 square feet is shockingly small. And I think that we really need to be careful about the kind of environment that we're creating. I think back, you mentioned the SRO, the single resident occupancy hotels. Remember, back in the 70s, we had terrible fires. Of course, those were in older buildings, not built to today's standards, where scores of people died in the fires, both the Ozark fire is one of them. When you pack a lot of people into a building, you have to be very certain that you're not creating an unhealthy or unsafe environment. And I do think that that's one of the things that we need to consider. Are our fire life and safety codes sufficient or appropriate for buildings like this with units as small as 90 square feet. I think 90 square feet is probably too small. We probably need to have a minimum such as 140 or 150 square feet.
What's the plan, by the way, for looking at these?
Again, we all want to have affordable housing options, and we don't want to, you know, discourage this as an option. So we're weighing about how we want to go about this. And I think probably what would be good is to have a discussion of this, perhaps a brown bag, and I've begun to talk a brown bag discussion during the lunch hour where we invite people in to talk about what's going on in the community, perhaps invite developers, invite neighborhood residents, as well as residents of the microhousing to get a better understanding of what's occurring.
Monday on Weekday, Jeannie Andel is going to take us on a tour of a micro apartment. It'll be a short tour, and we'll talk to a developer about a project. You heard from Tom Rasmussen, member of the Seattle City Council, talking about the rise of the microhouse in our region. Coming up, novelist Jodi Picoult.
KUOW, it's 10:16.
Being a citizen, for me, is the crucial aspect of this country. And while it may sound self-serving, I do think immigrants actually help this country.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright talks about politics and about her childhood in Prague at the onset of World War II. That's tonight, at 8 o'clock.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest public media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
52 degrees in Seattle, expecting a high today in the mid-50s. Clouds, rain likely this afternoon, and wind up to 13 miles an hour in the Seattle area. Tonight, expect a low in the upper 40s. With showers in the forecast.
Best-selling author Jodi Picoult explores the intertwined lives of Holocaust survivor and a former Nazi SS guard in her latest novel, The Storyteller. She is well known for bringing difficult subjects to popular fiction. Author of 19 novels, including number one New York Times bestsellers Sing You Home, House Rules, Handle With Care, Change of Heart, 19 Minutes, My Sister's Keeper. Her latest novel, The Storyteller, was published in February. Her new novel is going to be about elephants. I am talking to you about elephants for a good.
Great.
I'm a big fan of elephants.
Cool.
Thank you for talking to us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Jodi Picoult will be at Seattle Public Library, Central Branch, tonight at 7. Admission is free, talking about her work. What's the pendant you wear around around your neck?
Well, this is not the
pendant. You don't have it anymore.
This is a new gift.
Let's go with that gift first.
This is a gift from my husband, so it's just a little sliding diamond, but I like it because I never take my jewelry off. I basically live in it.
But, your husband is a good guy.
He's a great guy.
He gave you the other one,
too. He gave me another pendant, which I wore for many, many years on a leather chain that was an ancient coin from, I'm pretty sure it was Greece, and it had Pegasus on one side for creativity and Athena on the other for wisdom.
Yeah, it was very nice. I wanted to start with that because that was that seems to be your goal as a writer.
Well, thanks. I'll take that.
You want to be thinking. You want to be creative. You started out to be a writer, right? When you were a little kid.
Yeah, I was writing when I was 5 years old. My mom says the first book that I wrote was called The Lobster That Was Misunderstood. I'm amazed that I knew the word misunderstood when I was 5 years old. I illustrated it. And, you know, she was very encouraging to me as a mom. When I liked to write, she made sure I had time to write. When I was in classes with teachers who didn't foster writing, she would get me switched out of those classes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And so she knew that was your passion already.
She did. And, you know, she liked to write, too, as a kid. So I think she recognized that. And I don't think she had quite the same opportunities.
What did it do for you, being a writer as a kid?
Well,
a teen?
It gave me an outlet. You know, it was very much a creative outlet. I have huge journals full of poetry, really awful poetry when I was like 15. And I recently actually got one of them from my mom, and I was reading it thinking, wow, weren't you worried that I was suicidal? I mean, I don't remember feeling depressed at all, but boy, was that some really awful poetry. But, you know, I used it to process my feelings, and I used it to explore places that I didn't go because I was living in a pretty happy home in suburbia. I wrote a lot of short stories, and it really made me want to go and study writing formally at a university.
Well, you know, many of your characters, many of your stories have young people in turmoil and trauma.
Mm-hmm.
That is a far cry from what you had. Is that because you had the outlet?
I think actually the reason that I write what I do is because I have lived such a happy life. I mean, my parents are still happily married. You know, they still have the home I grew up in. I have a little brother and I like him. You know, I mean, I didn't have trauma in my family, really. And in fact, when I was in college, I remember asking my mom, calling her at one point and saying, is there maybe just like a little incest in the family I don't know about, you know? And thankfully, you know, there wasn't. But it meant that if I was going to write, I had to find things I wanted to write about. I had to learn about them because I didn't experience them myself.
How come you wanted to learn about those things?
I think it was because I had that safety net. I mean, I've actually thought about that a lot. If I had a very traumatic upbringing and if I had currently a traumatic life, it would be very hard for me to spend 8 hours a day writing about characters who are living the same kind of horrors.
Hmm.
I think it's because at the end of the day, I get to go downstairs and, you know, I have a great husband, I have great kids, I have 4 dogs, and, you know, it's a very easy, happy lifestyle. There's a very strong break for me between reality and fiction.
You have many readers who must write you saying, this rings true to me, this has helped me, this is important to me.
Yeah.
So isn't that interesting that you have that connection that way?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when you write fiction, you don't expect to change lives, but you do sometimes. And that is the biggest gift that you can receive as a fiction writer, is to get a letter like that from someone and hear that you have changed the course of their life because of something that you wrote.
Yeah, I think you said it. And you're very good and well-organized website.
Thank you.
There was, in your frequently asked questions, there was you answering that what keeps you going are the fans and the responses that you get from fans.
Yeah.
And you answer them.
I do, every single letter. Yeah.
You get a lot.
I get about 200 a day. Yeah, I don't have a secretary. It's just me. I'm a one-woman show. But I think it's
you
really...
You could, right? You could hire a secretary.
I could. Actually, I could pay my mother to do it at this point, you know. But I actually think that it's really important for me to be able to say, you know, there are millions of books out there. You picked mine. Thank you. And I can tell you from experience that even if you take the time to just write 2 or 3 sentences back to someone thanking them, they're a fan for life because, you know, how many of us wrote fan mail to a celebrity when we were little and never got a response or got an automated response? And I think it really means a lot to know that someone who you admire because of their writing sees you as a valuable person, too.
Jodi Picou is our guest. Well, you didn't have – I mean, you have written about your son and how he, as a young boy, had – what was his – what was the problem he had with his ears?
Jake, I've actually kind of written both sons. So.
Yeah, that's true. You have.
So Jake.
Oh, that's
was,
right. You have.
Jake,
they must love that.
Yeah, you know, I think I did ask Kyle's permission before I made him the poster child for gay rights. But
your son came out when he, the other son came out when he was 17.
Yeah, and it was in the middle of when I was writing "Sing You Home," which
right.
You know, was about gay rights. So it became a very personal story. Jakey actually was 5 years old when he was diagnosed with benign tumors in his ears that are not cancer, but that burrow towards the brain and kill you when they hit the brain. So you have to get rid of them. And the traditional way to get rid of it is to take down the ear canal wall, scrape out the tumor, and leave the child permanently deaf, but able to, you know, scrape out any regrowth that occurs. We chose a more experimental approach that would require Jake to have more surgeries overall, but that might preserve a little bit of his hearing. And it turned out to be the right decision because in the middle of 10 surgeries in 3 years, we learned that he had bilateral tumors. He had it in both ears, and there were only 9 kids in the U.S. that did. And after all these surgeries and a couple of reconstructive surgeries, he wound up profoundly deaf in his left ear and with marginal hearing in his right ear. He wore hearing aids for a little while. He actually has a pair at college now that he doesn't wear very often. And even his own surgeon does not really understand how he can hear as well as he does, given what his audiograms look like. Mm. More amazingly, he is an incredibly accomplished tenor singer and now sings with the Dukesmen of Yale and is actually in Jamaica right now singing with them on a tour.
You talked about how much you learned and admired his bravery.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still remember him, you know, going every time we had to go to the hospital. It was a 2.5-hour drive down to Mass Eye and Ear from where we lived in New Hampshire. And we would get in the car, and only once in 13 surgeries did I turn around in the back seat and just see that his eyes were glistening. Only once. You know, he just went into it like, okay, I'm going to get through it. I'm going to do it. And I remember being in his hospital room. And sitting with him after, you know. And I was always the one, we split up the duties. So I was the one who went with him in scrubs into the OR and held his hand while he was counting backward in anesthesia. And my husband was there when he woke up in recovery. But I remember sitting in his room after one of the surgeries. And it was when the doctor came out and told us, Jake doesn't just have this in one ear. He has this in both ears. And I remember being there and just, you know, talking to him and saying, it's going to be okay. You know, don't even think about this now. And walking out into the hall where the elevators were, and I lost it. Totally lost it, but I wasn't going to do that in front of him.
Jodi Picou is our guest. She is a best-selling novelist. Her latest is The Storyteller. You're a Princeton teacher, Mary Morris.
Yeah.
You said that she taught you to write.
She taught me everything I know.
What was her discipline? What did she apply that gave you the discipline?
Well, she I'll tell you about my first experience in her class. We had a workshop class, so there were like 12 of us. And when it was my day to talk about one of the stories I'd written, she had me sit down on the floor. She put everyone else's chairs around me. And she gave me construction paper, scissors, and a glue stick. And she said, don't talk, just listen. And she said, where does Jodi's story really start? Someone said, page 3? She goes, yeah. And she rips off pages 1 and 2. And she proceeded to have me cut and paste my story on the construction paper for the next hour and a half. I left that class in tears. I was so humiliated. And I went to her office hours the next day and I said, how could you do that to me? And she said, you needed it and you can take it. And I was so angry at her that I edited it and edited it and edited it until finally she said, why don't you do something with this? And I said, well, you know, what do you mean? I was writing it for a class. And she said, go send it to 17 Magazine. And that was the first story of mine that was ever published.
So that was good for you. Was she right that you had that resilience?
Totally right. Because, you know, I was
a straight
A student. I know. But, you know, she must have seen something in me that knew I needed to be challenged. I was a straight A student in high school. I had never cracked a book. I had it easy. I had never really been challenged. And, you know, I thought I was good. And I wasn't. I could be so much better. And she made me want to be better.
I am going to come to the story. I want to come to what you say about the what if as it gets you to write. But I want to ask you something about women and writers in this America today.
Yes,
it's a little aggravating. It's not just women and writers though. It's women in this world today.
Yeah.
How does it hit you? How does the continuing sexism that exists hit you?
I have been really vocal about it, and the way it hits me is that most often people say, "Oh, she's whining again." And unfortunately, I think when a successful woman opens her mouth, people say she's whining. That's it. You know, I hate that term. I'm not whining. I'm actually just reciting facts. It's embarrassing to me that even highly respected literary writers have said, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know the statistics. You know, I don't believe that. I think that Vita has made it very clear that female authors are less likely to be reviewed and are less likely to be reviewers themselves. A couple of review outlets have actually really tried to change that balance. But in 3 years, we've seen most of them have not.
Which ones have tried to change it?
Oh, is it Tin House? I think really has done a great job. They've really completely swung around in a couple of years' time to the point where they're, I think, you know, either 50-50 or a little even more balanced towards women, which is great.
Didn't you go to a new publisher?
I am after this book, yeah. Yeah. They had nothing to do with
that.
No, and, you know, the interesting thing is I'm not whining for me. I don't think you should say whining, but go ahead. But you know what I mean? There's this belief that I'm complaining because I wish I got those reviews. When in reality, I get a lot of reviews. I have a lot of success. I have a lot of readers. I am lucky because I write commercial fiction and I actually get reviews. Not everyone can say that. there are a lot of great commercial fiction writers and a lot of great female writers who do not get the same treatment that I do. So if I'm lucky enough to have a podium, I'm going to use it to say they need to be noticed.
You know, the chick lit, right? Which you don't mind as a phrase, but it can be. It can be
a great
way of getaway.
People read chick lit. It's fun. It's funny. I don't think I write chick lit.
No.
I think, unfortunately, there's an assumption that if you are a woman, that must be what you're writing. You know, once I was so tired of being called a women's fiction author that I actually tracked my email, and 47% of it comes from men. So,
oh, instead of a fiction author, you're a woman fiction author.
Yeah.
I see.
I am a female fiction author, but right. I am not a woman's fiction author.
Yeah, yeah,
I'd like to think that men get things out of my books, too, and they do. I just think it's lazy to assume that women write for women.
Jodi Picco is our guest. All right, you said a commercial author. Mm. What is that? Define that for me. From your perspective,
it's hard to define. It's a very arbitrary distinction. There's literary fiction and there's commercial fiction. Traditionally, literary fiction gets a lot of reviews, gets all the national prizes. There is an elitism to writing literary fiction that people admire. You know, those are the Philip Roths and the Joyce Carol Oates of the world.
I believe, yes, and Jonathan Franzen.
And
your very good friend Nicholas Sparks. I guess he's more like commercial.
He's definitely commercial. You know, and then there are the commercial writers like Patterson and like Nicholas Sparks, but also like, you know, I would say, Alice Hoffman's kind of a hybrid. I guess there are a lot of really wonderful commercial authors as well who don't get a fair shake because it's assumed they must be writing schlock. Because commercial fiction writers tend to publish more frequently, they have a much greater print run, so they're reaching more people. And they tend to get a lot of advertising behind their books. There's more promotion for them.
I see you at the airport.
Yeah, exactly.
I have to go around back to see the literature.
And you might not even find the literature there because it's a very select group, especially in an airport. I, a long time ago, got to make a decision through a publisher whether or not I wanted to be pitched as literary or commercial. And it is the way you're pitched. It's a marketing decision. And I said, you know, I'm going to write the same book no matter what. And I hope it's a good book. So I'd rather reach more people, you know. And that was why I chose to be a commercial writer. But I would like to believe that what I write is something that is well-researched, educational, provocative, makes you think, all of which are terms that would also apply to literary fiction.
Jodi Picco is our guest. All right, so you say that you ask yourself a what-if question. Mm-hmm. So what is the what-if question you ask yourself with the storyteller?
If you've done something really reprehensible in your life, can you spend the rest of your life trying to do good deeds and ever erase that stain from your soul? And by the same token, if you have been a morally good person, is there anything that could make you tip the balance and commit an immoral act, like, for example, killing someone?
And that just started you off.
That started it.
You did a lot. You went and talked to people, even that I didn't know. We still have an American Nazi hunter.
We have 35 of them.
35.
It's the Office of Human Rights and Special Prosecution in the Department of Justice. It's run by a guy named Eli Rosenbaum, who is fabulous. And he basically spends his time going after war criminals, including Nazis, even though they're in their 90s now. They have captured and deported tons of these people, hundreds of them. Now, what's interesting, what most people don't realize, is that until 2007, we had no jurisdiction over war criminals. Since then, if someone commits an act of genocide against an American, we can prosecute. Or if they commit genocide and hide in America, we can prosecute. But prior to that, all we can do is find the person, strip them of their citizenship, and ship them out of the country and hope that that country will prosecute. And he's done that in several cases. There was one, Arthur Rudolph was a very well-known rocket scientist who created the Pershing missile, the Saturn V rocket. He also happened to be a Nazi. You know, Eli was the one who got him deported.
What is the answer he gives and you give when somebody says, look, these guys are 90?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you pursue that?
This is really important. And that's why this book is so important. It was important for me to write because I wanted to answer that question. And it's a multifold answer. The first is that the Holocaust was not a Jewish problem. It's actually a human rights issue. 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. Well, 5 million non-Jews died in the Holocaust. So it's something everyone should really be concerned about. Second of all, there's no statute of limitations on murder. Third, we live in a country where we allow Nazi war criminals to live within our borders and sometimes even face their victims in the grocery store who've also made their lives here. But we routinely deport immigrants whose only crime is having the wrong paperwork or no paperwork. That seems very hypocritical. And finally, the reason that this is important and that Eli's department's important is that genocides are happening every day. And if the U.S. gets this reputation for being the police of genocides, it's going to go very far. And perhaps there's someone right now in Uganda with a gun up to someone's head who is going to say, you know what? They were hunting John Demjanjuk till he was 91. I don't want to be that person. And he puts that gun down. He runs away. Well, if you've saved even one life, it's worth doing what you do.
Well, that's the backstory. The storyteller is a lot about characters and the emotions of those characters. I just want to ask you also about this next book. What you have done a lot of research about elephants.
Yeah.
Even going to Tennessee going to the sanctuary there. Mm-hmm. I believe that we should start a campaign to bring elephants to the United States and release them in certain areas. Because we have to save elephants. And that's what this book is about, right?
Yeah, the book is actually about it's about grief and about loss and a woman who studies elephant grief and cognition. They're one of the few species that, like us, actually have grief rituals, and they're very profound and moving. If you watch elephants, they will come back to the spot where another elephant died for years and literally pay their respects. They get very quiet there. Their behavior changes. They've been known to break into research facilities that have bones that they're studying and take those bones back to the spot where the elephant died. You can see a calf go up to the skull of an elephant, recognize one particular skull out of many as its mother, and stick its trunk into her mouth, which is how he would have greeted her. It's pretty remarkable. There's so much in that is, devastating about elephants right now, especially in Africa with poaching. It is lovely to think that we could have elephant sanctuaries that could protect all these elephants that are orphaned from poaching. But the truth is we have a lot of elephants that we need to protect here in the U.S. And the nice thing about the sanctuary in Tennessee, the elephant sanctuary, is that they are basically a fabulous retirement community for elephants that have been put on display their whole life. Elephants who've been in circuses and elephants who have been in zoos that have had really horrific existences. And at this one place, they don't have to be anything but elephants. It's lovely.
Well, that's for 2014. Jody Picco's doing research on that. And that's the backstory. Jody Picco is a novelist with stories, characters. Her latest is The Storyteller, about dealing with Nazi war criminals and Holocaust survivors. She's speaking tonight, Seattle Public Library, Central Branch, 7 p.m. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
It's 10:37, KUOW 94.9, News and Information. New construction in South Lake Union would block the view of the Space Needle from a park in South Lake Union. What views from public spaces are protected? We'll hear all about that this afternoon on The Conversation at 12:20.
Evening tours of KUOW's broadcast facility are now available to listeners ages 15 and older. This month's tour is Thursday, March 21st at 6:15 p.m. Space is limited. To schedule a tour, call 206-543-2710 or email tours at kuow.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, recognizing people have a choice about where they're treated for cancer. At SCCA, doctors from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Seattle Children's unite to turn cancer patients into cancer survivors. More at seattlecca.org.
52 degrees and holding steady in Seattle, but expecting a high today in the mid-50s. Clouds and rain likely this afternoon. Breezy as well. A wind up to 13 miles an hour. Tonight's low around 48 with showers expected. Looking for a good lunch spot? Food writer Sarah Dickerman offers some ideas. That's ahead in 15 minutes.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles speaking from London.
King County.
from tap dancing to old-time radio. Katie Sewell, you've been thinking a lot about sound lately and sound effects artists, right?
That's right.
I thought yeah. so.
I have. I was going to have Andy do a little horn there, but yeah, there we go. That's my response.
Oh, I see. That's what you wanted.
Oh, well.
You wanted the horn. You could do that all the whole time. You could just have a horn. Why? What do you? Because we love sound. That's why, right?
Yeah. Well, sound effects men were in such high demand during the Golden Age with all those hours of content, of course, to produce. There were shows that they had to work on day and night. And sound men actually back then actually worked a 40-hour work week.
The sound man was always working.
He worked a 40-hour week.
Probably
but
a sound
was,
man, too, huh?
It was probably a man. There were a few women, and I'm actually going to do a show about them. But it was mostly men that did it. They worked a 40-hour week, but their hours changed dramatically from week to week. For example, if you were hired, say, Steve, to work on a live show at 8 a.m., it's possible that you would stay at the studio working different shows all day long throughout the day until you got to 1 a.m.
Yikes.
When a lot of the stations went off the air, which means you've already done 17 hours of your work week. So some days, you know, you're only working a couple days a week. But that kind of rotation and schedule means that you're working with a lot of different directors over the course of your day. And many of them were excellent. And but for fun today, I thought we would talk about the ones that were not excellent, the ones that sound effects men had a hard time working with. And there are a lot of types, but I picked three.
All right, which three?
First type are the brand new directors. And you could always tell a new director by their attitude about one little sound effect.
Good evening, slugger. You see, I'm prompt, slugger.
Footsteps.
That's a little creepy there.
Yeah. That
guy was creepy.
That's a show called A Little Piece of Rope. The frightened woman there was Lucille Ball. But footsteps, you see, so new directors often read a book that was called Radio Directing. It was written by a man called Earl McGill, who was a really well-known director at the time. And in that book, Earl wrote about the temptation to add too many sound effects. As he put it, and this is a quote, "If one were to believe radio producers, there isn't a house in the whole of the United States that can boast having rugs or carpeting on its floors." So when a director said to the sound man, "No footsteps, the people in my script can afford their carpeting," that's when the sound effects man knew that they were dealing with somebody who was brand new.
So they had to figure that out, think about how they were going to work with that person.
Yes.
What else?
Another difficulty was working with a fill-in director on foreign shows. There was a show called Radio Free Europe that was made in the United States, but it was for audiences in places like Hungary or Yugoslavia. So all of the actors hired on the show don't speak any English. And the sound effects department is completely dependent, therefore, on the director for their cues. But every now and then, the native-speaking director would fall ill or a conflict would happen, and they would end up with a fill-in director who also couldn't understand the language. And that's when things like this would happen. So picture that we're in a scene, it's an office, and the sound effects man is making a typing sound. And he just keeps typing. And meanwhile, the characters leave the office and they've walked out into the hall and they're going down the hallway and he's still typing. And then the characters go downstairs and they end up on the street. No, Radio 4.
There you go. Oh, I see.
And he's still typing.
This was just like what you were describing. Katie's the new director. And you're just a sound effects guy, Andy. So they're typing while the typing is still going on and the street sound is
yeah,
happening.
Which makes, of course, no sense to the listener. They even joke that sometimes it would follow them all the way home to their bedroom where they're greeting their wife. You know, it would just go on and on.
I think you should just keep the typing going the entire time. No, don't.
It's hard to set the scene, Steve, when you don't know what the scene is.
Yeah, I get that.
Okay, so there are other directors that were tough. There were directors who wanted sound effects men to be busy on every single page, and they were their own pain. But the hardest of all directors to work for as a sound man was the visual directors. These were the directors who not only wanted to sound a scene to sound authentic, but it also had to look authentic, too. So you take something like a person falling down the stairs.
That's... That's a person falling down the stairs?
Yes, that's a sound you can actually make without falling down the stairs. You can do it by knocking over a bunch of suitcases or something like that. But not if you have a visual director. Visual director wants you to fall down the stairs. So the Columbia Workshop did a show called A Man with a Gun. And the story was told by sound effects only with music and the voice of only one actor. So it was sort of experimental at the time. Because there were so many sound effects, there were seven men that were hired for the job. And unfortunately, they had a visual director in charge of the production. So one of them literally had to fall down a flight of stairs.
I'm trapped. I can't get out. They're locked. They're all locked. I'm stuck. Get out of the way, you stinking coppers. I'm coming. Don't try to stop me. Don't shoot, copper. Don't shoot. It's murder. Wait. But I'll get you just the same. I'm on my way out now to wherever you are. I'm gonna get you anywhere.
So, Ray Erlenborn was...
I like the gurgling.
Yeah, it's good. The actor does a pretty good job in that. Ray Erlenborn was the sound man who did the fall. We could call him the stunt man, I suppose, in this case. And to make the sound, he fell down the stairs head first, you know. He was used to doing comedy pratfalls, and so that's the way he could control his motion the best. But during the rehearsal, he got into an argument with another sound man who was insisting that the sound would sound a lot better if Ray would come down butt first. Ray refused, and the other sound man said, well, fine, I'll demonstrate. And he was right. The sound actually did sound a lot better when you fell down butt first, but it also sent him to the hospital with a fractured tailbone. I did put the whole entire show, Man with a Gun, on our Facebook page, by the way, if anyone wants to look it up.
Really?
Weekday on KOW.
If they want to listen to the
If they want to hear the whole
falling
whole
down
story.
Butt first.
The most famous of visual directors was this guy.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles, your producer of a special series of broadcasts presented by the makers of Pabst Blue Ribbon, the Mercury Summer Theater of the Air.
So it's odd to me, actually, and I bet you would agree that Orson Welles would be a visual director.
Yeah. So even in radio, he was thinking like when you say visual director, you just basically mean they were bringing a visual sense into it when it wasn't supposed to be.
Right. It, a great example would be if I'm a sound effects man and I am supposed to be playing checkers. And I don't have any checkers, so I go and I slice pieces of a broom. So I have little circles to move around. And a visual director would come in and be like, what is this? And you'd say, well, these are the checkers. And they'd be like, these aren't checkers. You know, go to the store and buy some checkers.
It's very funny.
It's
to think that
sort of attitude.
Today we have people that, you know, need a watermelon to be smashed if you want a head to make a sound like it's exploding, to be graphically gross. But, right, I mean, it's yeah. All other things that Foley people are using.
Yeah.
Not the actual thing.
Well, and I don't know. I'm sure there are some visual directors out there still who would want something more authentic. Anyway, I just thought it was odd that he was like that since he acted on the radio all the time. But I wanted to end with a great example of this visual directing going wrong for Orson Welles. He was directing a desert story for the Mercury Theater on the Air. And for the desert, now normally for desert footsteps, sound men use a little square tray that's filled with sand. And then there's a little microphone right next to that tray that's miking it to amplify the sound. And Orson just hated the notion of
that. And they use shoes then? Or
yeah, or they'll actually stand in it and
walk.
Oh,
I see.
He hated the idea of it. You know, and he was not one to keep his displeasure to himself. So he told the sound effects men that there was no way that his footsteps in his desert story were going to be made in a box that cats would poop in. Is how he put it. And he said, I will get 100 bags of sand and I will cover the studio. And then the actors can make their own footsteps. And he did it. He dumped the sands of Coney Island all over the floor of the studio. Now, Steve, I thought it would be kind of fun for us to do a little experimental radio here and personally demonstrate why this doesn't work, if you're willing, of course.
I'm willing.
All right. So I bought
That's why I'm here.
I bought a bag of aquarium sand here from the local pet store, and I'm going to dump it on the floor. Much to the ops department's dismay, I'm sure. I'm going to dump it on the floor. It's just a little bag. So here we go.
spread it out a little bit there. Okay. Now, you're going to take this script here that you have, and you're going to stand in the sand, and you're going to walk, and you're going to hold the mic by your lips. Hold the mic by your lips and deliver the lines, and Andy is going to continually raise the level until he can hear the sand and you talk.
I could have told him that what the incense was. I smell cinnamon and myrrh and spikenard too often not to recognize it instantly. When I opened the door to my room, the smell was almost overpowering, used as I am to the funeral spices of ancient Egyptian tombs. No! I'm not going to tell you that a beautiful Egyptian princess of the days of Hyksos was waiting for me in the darkness. This isn't a ghost story, it's a true story. There wasn't anyone in the room. I turned on the lights, opened the window. There wasn't anyone in the room. So I went to bed, dreamed about sailing on Lake Michigan. A storm came up and thunder crashed.
That's probably good.
Are you sure? That's good?
That's probably good.
So what happened there?
So, I don't know that anybody could ever hear the sand. While they were listening, now you're holding the mic actually up to the sand, which would be the way to do it.
Proper way to do it.
What happened there is, obviously, to try to hear the sand, you had to elevate the level so high that you're distorted. If I was shuffling papers around, you'd hear every cough from the back room. It just wasn't practical. Like, it just wasn't going to work. And luckily, and to his credit, Orson Welles realized after doing this rehearsal that sounded absolutely terrible, that it wasn't going to work. And by the time the sound men returned from their dinner break, they had all the sand back on Coney Island removed from the studio.
Let's hope that happens, Katie.
Yeah.
Here in this studio.
That Orson Welles will show up. And,
well, just somebody does before the ops people sand. Show up and say, what is all this sand doing on the floor of the studio? Or we could leave it for Ross.
Ross
could do a whole sand-based show this afternoon.
Well, we'll just tell him that he needs to set it in the desert. Thank you, Andy.
All right, on that note, I appreciate it. Yeah, you coming in.
Pleasure.
This is Weekday. Sarah Dickerman?
Yeah.
I was wondering if, after listening to that hot, sandy scene with the sand, if you, as somebody who joins us every Thursday and offers us some lunch recommendations, got thinking about, you know, I don't know, Mediterranean cuisine at all. I was wondering how good my acting was.
Well, you know, I'm not thinking very Mediterranean this week. In fact, I'm thinking about good old strapping breakfast food and how I've been seeing a little bit of breakfast creep into other meals.
Good. So breakfast deserves to be in other meals.
Exactly. I was saying to a friend that I don't usually want like a big old breakfast when I first wake up. I'm a very like oatmeal type person. So by the time I'm ready for those wonderful breakfast treats like biscuits and waffles and pancakes, it's usually too late. And so I celebrate places that allow me a little longer window to get my breakfast treats. And one of them is this nice place down in Columbia City called Empire Espresso.
That sounds very nice. By the way, Sarah Dickerman writes for Slate, New York Times. She blogs at sarahdickerman.com. She joins us every Thursday to talk about, you know, to give us a place to go to lunch, or in this case, late breakfast. Now, can I get a late breakfast at Empire Espresso, or do I have to be there before a certain time?
You can. First of all, you can get excellent espresso there. They are very, very good espresso makers. And but then they do this. They serve waffles all day, and they serve sweeter waffles. But you know, if you like a more savory taste, I recommend the ham and scallion and creme fraiche waffle.
That sounds very nice.
And their batter is a really interesting one that's kind of rich, a little on the sort of eggy side with some cornmeal in it. So it's very golden and almost, you know, got that almost custardy inside with a delicate crust on the outside. Excellent. But they also have things like Nutella and banana waffles and lime and powdered sugar. So they have some fun combinations. Excellent coffee. They have soccer on the TVs often with the sound off, so it's kind of a fun place to catch up on the midday games if you're into that too.
That's interesting about waffles and breakfast creep. You know, I was sad to see a little espresso waffle shop right on the Ave below our business. And they closed down. I guess they didn't sell enough waffles.
Oh, that is too bad. Yeah. And then there's the classic, there's a Rosa coffee place down in Madison Valley that does the Belgian style waffles too, where, you know, there's little bits of pearl sugar that hit the waffle iron and kind of caramelize. And those are very good. Those are more like a harder portable form of waffle.
Yeah. The waffle is a good portable food if you do it right. Where else do you see this breakfast creep happening?
Well, Skillet, you know, the various outlets of Skillet, you know, which we started as a food truck and it now has a diner and has a place in Seattle Center, they often do a form of either chicken and waffles or pork belly and waffles. And so, you know, that's another option. And there's another one that I've forgotten
Taste.
Right now.
Taste?
Oh, yeah, Taste also does chicken and waffles. Yeah, so you can find, you know, that's sort of a classic Southern option for your combo waffle treat.
Breakfast creep. Well, it's interesting because you go around on a Saturday or a Sunday and people are lined up all sorts of breakfast places, so there must be demand.
I actually think there's an economic reason for some of this, although not necessarily in the cases of like the espresso shop. You know, a lot of good restaurants are trying to maximize every dollar they can from their lease. So, you know, a lot of restaurants around town have gone the brunch way where they might not have 5 years ago because they didn't want to have to staff up a weekend shift and, you know, chefs stay out late. They don't always want to cook breakfast. But it's become really worthwhile for them to fill those tables during the weekend daytime hours.
Chefs stay out late. You and Anthony Bourdain out all night. All right, tell me something. You're thinking about Marion Cunningham's book, The Breakfast Book, as a with another kind of waffle, not quite the same kind of waffle that you get at the Empire Espresso Shop?
It's true. So there's a famous recipe that Marion Cunningham, who's a really great food writer, who rewrote the Fanny Farmer cookbook as well. And she has this beautiful book, The Breakfast Book, and it has this very cult-like waffle recipe, which is called, I think she calls them raised waffles. They have a little bit of yeast in them, and you make them the night before you're going to cook, and they raise overnight. And so they have this incredible, very crispy, feathery texture to them, a little, and they're not very sweet. And some people love them. I love them. And then there's also interesting writing about them online where, you know, some people try them and they're like, oh, they're not sort of sweet and indulgent enough. They're not quite what I was looking for in a waffle. So there's a lot of, like, sort of meta-waffle writing about this particular kind of waffle from The Breakfast Book by Marion Cunningham.
The meta-waffle. Very nice. Very nice. All right, Sarah, I appreciate that. Empire Espresso Shop, Breakfast Creep, Taste, Skillet, lots of others. And then The Breakfast Book, Marion Cunningham, her waffle recipe. And don't forget Meta Waffles. You talked about that. Orangette.blogspot.com is a blog that has something. And also the WednesdayChef.com where people can look and read about the Meta Waffle phenomenon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Sarah Dickerman writes about food and restaurants, Slate, the New York Times, also at our own website, sarahdickerman.com. Hey, we had a very young radio fan, Michaela, as well as her dad, Gary, come in to want to watch us produce the radio retrospective. Who says radio's dead? Radio lives. Nine-year-olds even care about what happened in old-time radio and might just be making the next great radio age happen. Jack Walters is our engineer. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Magano, Amin Al-Sadi, Andy Hurst. I'm Steve Scher. We will talk to you again on the morrow.
It's 10:59. KUOW 94.9 News and Information. The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system. This has been a test of the emergency alert system.
American Roots follows the journeys of folklorist Alan Lomax as he recorded the music of America and the world. We'll look into Lomax's work as a sound recordist, cultural activist, radio host, and above all, shape.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.